Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, you're listening to Travis Johnson, the Nonprofit Architect, helping you build a stronger nonprofit. To help keep my shows on the air, consider giving $5 a month at patreon.com/nonprofitarchitect. I'm here with the fantastic fundraiser, Patrick Kirby, who has got the $3 million yes before, and he wants to help you do good better. Check out his new book, Fundraise Awesomer, on Amazon. Patrick, welcome. How are you doing today?
I couldn't be better if I tried. The sun is shining. Our Vikings won yesterday, and I get to spend the foreseeable future talking about nerdy fundraising stuff with you, which is my favorite thing in the entire world.
Well, it's funny that you say it's your favorite thing, because I think most people in the nonprofit world would disagree with you. But I think that's because they don't have the knowledge, skill set, format, background, and tips and tricks that you're going to provide today. They don't have that. From our earlier conversations, what they end up being is an accidental fundraiser. Like, everyone's like, nose goes, and the last person to put their finger on their nose turns out to be the fundraiser, and they're like, well, I don't know how to do what it is I'm doing. So tell us about what it is that you do.
I am a nonprofit consultant. I own a business called Do Good Better, a consulting firm. As I like to say, helping nonprofits suck less at fundraising. I found that that's an easier term to explain to people in the room. I just recently published a book, like you mentioned, Fundraise Awesomer. It's a practical guide to staying sane while doing good. I've really kind of come to the conclusion I've been on this earth for a purpose, and that's to help small and medium-sized nonprofits raise more money, have more fun, and realize that it's not as overwhelming as it makes it out to be. But really just to kind of simplify and uncomplicate their fundraising life, and then realize, wow, this is just basically having conversations with people and aligning them with our values at whatever our mission statement is. And then that weight is sort of lifted off of their shoulders, and then it does become fun. And you can be like one of us, these magical unicorns that actually like talking about fundraising, that most people just hear it and they just shy away from it. So I have I'm kind of celebrating year number two as a business owner, but I've had about 15 years of real sort of in the field hardcore fundraising experience, and I've probably seen 94% of every scenario ever put forth when it comes to fundraising, and I would love to spread the good word and joy and knowledge and experience that I've got with those who are just feeling overwhelmed and overworked in the old nonprofit world.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. I'm definitely a novice when it comes to fundraising. I have one organization I was the board on that it really wasn't the focus, and I have another organization where they did fundraise, but it was a concert partnership. The only fundraiser they did was concerts. They paid to have people swing through Oklahoma City on the way to someone else and help pay some of their bills up front for a portion of the tickets.
Right.
But from what I understand, really the biggest hurdle is the first hurdle.
Yes.
And that is the ask. The ask on behalf of not you, but behalf of the organization.
Right.
How hard is it to get the ask?
I think it's harder to imagine yourself asking for money than it actually is asking for money. I think people hype themselves up. It's kind of like, have you ever bungee jumped, or have you ever done a roller coaster? Like, you're watching everybody else on the roller coaster. You're watching people do bungee jumping. And you're like, well, there's no way I'll ever be able to do that. Or there's no way I'm going to muster up enough energy or courage to do what they're doing. And really, once you get to the top of this thing, you fly off of it, or you go down the roller coaster, you realize that it's actually not that scary. But you hype yourself up to it. And I think making an ask is really the last and least amount of work you do when you're building relationships with donors, right? If you're at the ask point, especially when you're talking about major gifts, large gifts, big sponsorship dollars, that's the smallest and least amount of work that you have to do as a fundraiser. The majority of work done building the relationship, knocking down doors, opening up a dialogue, really aligning the person you're asking with your organization. Like, that's where all the hard work is. And that's where a lot of the stress level can be. And then you get to the ask and you're like, hey, this was pretty easy because all you're doing is saying, hey, would you consider a gift? And they're like, yep, that sounds great. And that's it. And that's their only thing that you're doing with your ask. But the work that goes into telling your story, aligning your donors with your organization or a program that you have at your organization, getting to know them on a more personal level, like that takes the time, energy, enthusiasm, and really love of what you do as a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. That's a lot more work and a lot more heavy lifting than it is an ask, because an ask is just a confirmation of everything that you did prior to. And it's just a symbolic money version of endorsing your organization. It's like, here's a check. I like you so much. Here's a check. Mm-hmm. And then to get to that point, you have so much more work to do. And it's that can be a little more overwhelming when you kind of reverse engineer that you just really need to think about relationship building than you do making an ask.
Do you think that the people that really struggle with the ask are the people that try to ask too soon before the story, before the relationship, before identifying their ideal donor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the individuals who are overly stressed about making ask, are obsessed or so worried about money, mm-hmm. like from an organization standpoint, than they are worried about anything else. So it's the organizations that need to have and are desperate to have that find themselves in trouble because all they can get is transactional gifts, right? We need to keep the doors open. My God, if we don't raise $1,000 today, we're doomed, right? The sky is falling mentality. Or the individuals who don't think that there's enough money for them or their organization in the world. Oh God, if we don't get this one gift from this one person, there's no more money left available to us in the entire universe. And we're all doomed to going under, right? So it's the people who are just obsessed with the idea of transaction and can't see the long-term benefits of these transformative gifts that you get through relationship building. And I think so the people who are just very nervous about making asks are the ones that just don't understand the idea of abundance or the idea of there's enough money to go around. Now you look at it, there's just an article yesterday in the from The Hill that said Facebook raised $2 billion from their little Facebook fundraisers that they do online. $2 billion. A billion of that's from birthday fundraisers, mm-hmm. right? So if you don't think that there's enough money in this universe, you are sorely mistaken. And you haven't looked outside enough of your, you know, sort of circles to get that perspective. And once you turn that corner, once you turn the corner to say, okay, if I think long term, if I think for, let's just say not tomorrow, but for maybe the next month, 6 months or a year, how do I develop relationships well enough that they would want to join us on this long term journey? The idea of making an ask is way easier and way less stressful, I think.
So, I mean, we talked about, you already mentioned the power of the story and the power of the relationship. And to be honest, I think this is interview number 13. Congratulations. Number 13.
Lucky number 13. I like that.
Lucky number 13.
You won 13. That's great.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. But it seems that we touch on the story and the relationship on almost every single podcast I've done up until this point. Obviously, you're running a nonprofit. You have some kind of story, some kind of reason, some kind of why. And if you can't articulate that and make that make sense and bring the audience, the donors, the volunteers, the board along for the ride of the journey, I really don't think you have anything to stand on, anything to build on, nothing to work on until you get that story fine-tuned and honed. You don't have anything. And as far as relationships go, you can't build relationships unless you're willing to tell that story and then listen. I think listening is the key. Listening to the donors and how that story impacts them or their similar story and the thing that they want to use to basically latch onto your vision and your idea. And am I hitting the head on the nail on the head?
Nailing it. Yeah, if you don't know what your story, you're doomed because you don't have any foundation. What you said was really intriguing too, is because listening to your donors and asking questions that don't involve the size of their checkbook is critical. Because if you're asking questions that don't revolve around how many stocks and bonds and investments and how much their property is worth and what they could do for you from a donation standpoint, how are you supposed to connect this amazing story or these amazing programs that you are having in your community with them? Because you're just concerned, like, money is a thing, right? But if you're not emotionally connected to it, it might be a one-time gift and that's the last thing you'll ever see from it. So really listening and asking questions. I had a great mentor that taught me a really interesting lesson of you're never allowed to ask for a major gift unless you know the name of your donor's dog. And I think that's such a wonderful analogy to say, if you don't know the things about them personally that their friends, family, colleagues, and neighbors do, what gives them the idea that you are thinking properly about where their money's going to go and what their major investment's going to be by supporting you? And you have to take the time to do that. You have to curate relationships that are deeper than transactions. And yeah, you need to know your story. And I'm glad you got 12 other people saying the same thing, because that's just so important. But once you have that story, how do you connect it to somebody that may not know who you are? And it's okay not to be connected to everybody, right? I think we're so obsessed with the idea, like people say the word no, like, oh, I'm not really interested in that. Okay, great. That's one less thing you got to worry about. You're like, oh, I wonder if that person's really interested. No, it gives clarity. And in fact, your job as a fundraiser is to connect people with purpose, regardless if it's yours or not. And I know that's tough to say, but if you can be that person to say, listen, I don't think we're a good fit, and that's totally okay, but you know who you might be a good fit with is this organization. To have the audacity to want the best for the donor is going to translate exponentially in the community in which you were fundraising, to make sure that you know that what you are mainly concerned with is the donor rather than you. It's not your need to have, it's the donor's need to give. And making that connection is so critical. And if you don't have a story, yeah, you don't go anywhere. And in fact, to double down on that too, do you have a story and do you have something that people can connect with monetarily? So are you just telling a story for the sake of telling stories, or are you giving them the option to say, hey, listen, $1,000 is going to do this, this, and this? And if you don't know that, you better learn that as well. I think a lot of people, when I ask clients or potential clients or just people in the community, I usually ask them, if I give you $1,000 right now, what is that going to do? And you would be surprised at how many people give you a blank stare back. Like, well, I've never thought about that. I go, well, you should, because someone's going to ask you that question. And even if it's $100 or $250 or 10 bucks, know where that money goes and what impact that makes, because that's part of your story. Mm-hmm. And so take the time to really curate an idea of what your donation or what you're soliciting is actually going to make maximum impact on.
That is vital to the success of any nonprofit. If you're listening to this, you have to know your numbers. If they say, hey, what percentage of this goes to the cause and what percentage goes to the overhead, you need to be able to answer that.
Yes.
And it better not, excuse me, it better not be a stupid number. You better able to say that 88% goes directly to the cause, 12% right. Overhead. I don't know what number is ideal, but in my mind, if you've got more than 15% overhead, you're not doing the right thing. You're not having your money go to the goal, to the vision, to the mission statement of the nonprofit, if your overhead is too high. Yeah. And I think the problem that people run into early is they get a big gift, and instead of figuring out a way to maximize that to go to their vision, they try to increase their building, their staff, the whatever, and they get over their head early.
You don't have to be a pauper about it. You don't need a penny for every dollar raised. A penny goes to our foundation, like our, you know, organizational structure. You don't have to be a pauper. Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, which is kind of where I use my bellwether of what people are doing, is roughly around like 78% to 85% of your donations go to mission. The rest can go to sort of your organization. That's kind of where they start their stats. Everybody's different. Now, what you can do, as well is don't be bogged down with the idea. Two things. One, if you need to justify money going to operations, which we all know operation is like the most important thing, and yet it's the least sexy thing to donate to, right? Part of your operation is part of your program. And if you don't have a program director for whatever service you're having, if you don't have that person, can't afford that person because you're not raising money for it, you don't have a program. So it's okay, in my opinion, and I've been doing this for a long time, it's okay, in my opinion, to have that program director as part of your programming. It's okay to lump that in with what you're kind of talking about. So I really do think that it's okay to talk about. The second thing is, if you don't know the answer to something, like, you need to know your numbers. Like, you shouldn't be soliciting large gifts or major gifts if you're like clueless about stuff. But if your donor asks you a specific question that you don't know, like an in-depth one you didn't prep for, don't get discouraged, and you can say the word, I don't know. Be authentic about knowing your stuff. And if you say, I don't know, follow it up with something along the lines with, I don't know the answer right now, but I do know somebody who does. Is it okay if I get that answer to you ASAP? Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing. So I think people are very terrified of going out and making asks because they don't know 100% of all the answers. And it's okay not to know, because it gives you another touch point. It gives you another reason to come back to that donor and say, hey, listen, remember you asked me that question? You may have forgotten it. I didn't. I wanted to make sure I got it to you. The answer is this. I just thought you should know. And then you can ask them permission while saying, I don't know, hey, would it be okay if I got a hold of you to get you that answer? And they're going to say, of course. And they gave you permission to go have another conversation with them. That's another touch point, another chance to build relationships. And all of a sudden, you look like a rock star, because you took it upon yourself to take time out of your day to go pursue the question that was probably meaningless in your conversation, but very meaningful to them. And now you look like you went above and beyond, because you did. And not a lot of organizations are going to take that time to build out some of that. So know your numbers. It's okay not to know, unless you then come back to them and actually use it as another touch point too. That's part of the terrifying, like we started the conversation about, like, people being very concerned with asks. They're very concerned about not knowing everything. And it's okay to not know everything.
Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to not know everything. And it's okay to admit that you don't know everything. It seems that too many times, I mean, nonprofit stuff aside, in this society right now, you see it on every interview on TV. People feel like they need to have the answer, the quick draw. That you can't possibly know everything.
No.
I've been in the Navy for 19 years. I've got mountains of qualifications, some of which would make you blush. And every single day I have questions. Or yes. I'm like, you know what? I have to check that reference. I have to look at it. I don't have all that stuff memorized. I can't possibly have thousands upon thousands of pages memorized. That's why we have Google. Right. Yeah. That's why we have answers at our fingertips, because there's no possible way we can do this. But you get asked the ask and you say, you know what? I got about 80% of that answer in my head, but I want to make sure I get you the 100% answer. Is it okay if I get back to you? And it's a no problem. It's no big deal. And they would appreciate that more, as opposed to you lying to them or bullshitting them or filling them with fluff to come back with a real no kidding answer. And you add that touch point, which I think is important.
Right. And I think you sound way more salesy if you're like, well, according to my, like, nobody knows. You know that you don't know. And they could, and a lot of your donors will have a BS alarm in their brain. They're way more savvy at this than you probably think they are. And they can tell somebody who's not passionate about it, or they are passionate about it, and all of a sudden they get a question and they go into robot mode because they're very not knowledgeable about it, or they don't know and they're just like kind of making it up on the fly. People are very savvy when it comes to how you communicate and tell stories and give answers. So be authentic, be honest, and be happy to go get them the answers, but also be realistic that you're not going to know everything. It's okay.
We've been talking a little bit about the big gift, the large donation. I want to see what the other side of the coin looks like. What's the best way that you know how to secure small to medium-sized monthly commitment?
It's a great question. Oddly, I've been getting that a lot, because I think people are looking at either the global economy and they're looking like, how can I secure our organization against a financial tide of woe, right? And I think monthly donations is probably one of it. So a couple of things. How do you get low-level gifts? You have to tell your story to as many people as possible, and that involves going out to every service club you can, every opportunity to speak you do, every small group, every business, wherever you can go to tell your story, do it, because it's going to resonate with somebody. And I think that's really, really important. I love events for this particular reason, because you can trap them in a room for a specific amount of time and just talk to you about your story and your mission and give your enthusiasm. It's a great deal for that. People don't like events because it's a logistical headache and nightmare, but I think it's invaluable because you can control the environment by which you are telling your story. Once you get them in, and it's really learning a lesson from churches, schools, and hospital systems, because they do the monthly giving better than anybody else, because they're in constant contact with them and they sort of see the value in it. First, you're going to need a system to do it. So make sure that you have a system at your organization that allows monthly payments, and then really talk to them about the size of the gift that they can make in chunks that are incremental. There's a reason why you watch late night TV and you see Ron Popeil out there talking about a rotisserie, and there's a reason he gives you three easy payments of $33.33, right? I can do three easy payments of $33.33. I can't afford $100. And what they realize over time is that if you get them in at a low level, they don't have to think about it. They probably will never cancel on you because they see the value of it. And then it's reminding them consistently how much value that they have been giving you or how much impact you've been making, and that it hasn't affected them financially on the back end as well. So it's offering a program that says you can do a lot for a little that's going to add up to a ton. And I think that's the planning behind that is a conversation you have to have with as many people as possible to get your pitch correct, because each organization has a donor base relatively different. So every time you go to church, pass the hat around, right? They pass the little basket around, you're giving.
Right.
I think a lot of people think if I'm getting an annual gift or I'm getting monthly givings, I can't ask them for anything else. Also not true, right? A great example of this, and a mentor of mine also sort of mentioned this, which was when you're at a church and pastor, priest comes up to the pulpit and says, hey, everybody, we're going to build a new gym for the kids. We're going to do a second pass around the gift. They know that your gift for the gym does not exclude you from giving when the old hat comes around anyway, right? This is in addition to. People understand intuitively that this is a specific and separate gift. And so don't get bogged down with the idea that if your annual giving goes away or your monthly giving, you can't tap them for anything else as well. This is just in addition to. And you have to relay that message that your small gift monthly will make massive impact for the long term continuously. And as an organization, if you can build this and know exactly how many donors you have giving monthly, that really frees you up financially to know what's coming in on a regular basis you don't have to think about or overthink about. And I think so it's really critical to do. But sell it as a small gift that's going to make long-term impact, that your $100 gift divided by 12, is only X amount of dollars per month. And then get the system that's going to allow you to do that.
So I've been part of groups and we've talked about someone's up at the front. They're like, you're feeling like you're going to give $1,000 today. I don't want $1,000 today. What I want is a $100 a month commitment. And they take the 10% of wherever the gift is. I don't want your $100 a month. I want our $100 gift. I want $10 a month. And throughout the year, that $10 adds up to $120. And chances are they won't cancel that gift, like you were saying.
Yeah. And the only thing that you need to worry about is just have them sign something that says, I'm going to give you $10 a month and I can cancel any time in writing. Mm-hmm. So you have them, that's the cancellation policy. And it's like you get cable. And you add on HBO, and maybe you don't watch anything HBO, and you haven't watched HBO since Game of Thrones went off, but you still have HBO because it takes work to log into your account and cancel it. I'll just pay the $9 a month, right? So you always do that. I think a lot, and it was brought up in a conversation recently about how maybe treat it like a Netflix subscription, mm-hmm. right? Give them value every single month to realize that they are doing good works at $14 a month. The same way that Netflix does. They roll out a show. They put up a new movie that you're like, oh, I haven't seen that forever. You'll never watch it. But the idea that it's there is comforting, right?
Right.
And so your mission at the organization is, hey, we did this with your gifts. Oh, that was kind of cool. I'll continue on. Like, you don't think about it because you know that you're a part of the team and you're part of the crew that made it happen. And I think that's really important too, where you need to loop everybody into the idea that you're part of this larger organization, a larger crew of people who are making massive impact together. That togetherness, that bond, that team feel is really important when you're doing monthly giving programs as well.
So I'm wearing a shirt right now for Storm Ministry, Strategic Treatment Options and Recovery Ministries, and they got me. They said, if you sign up at $25 a month, you get a free t-shirt. Right? And you sign up, you get the free t-shirt, and like you said, you don't spend the time it takes to cancel. You get someone on your team wearing your swag with your name on it,
yep.
And that allows you to build people and give them an opportunity to identify with your group. Now, you and I are both a fan of one of the biggest nonprofits out there, the National Football League, and we both yes. identify as Minnesota Vikings fans, and you better right. believe I've got a Minnesota Vikings jersey, actually. I've got a couple of them, and I'm sure you're the same way. And it allows yep. us to show people out there who we are and who we support and who we identify as. And, if you're listening, you may or may not like the Vikings. They may be the villain in your life, and, I'm okay with that. But you have to give your tribe, your group, your people the opportunity to identify with you and fly your flag.
Yeah. And again, social media gives you such a powerful tool here where, hey, post your t-shirt in different places in which you travel. What a wonderful content piece you have right there that doesn't cost you a dime, that people are then endorsing your organization across the pond, or they're endorsing you at events or wherever they are. United Way does a wonderful job of this. A lot of the larger ones have gotten really that gist. And you should own that. If you're a small or medium-sized nonprofit that says, well, I'm not a United Way, why not? Use their tactics and use their do it for a reason. It works. So really embracing the idea of, like you said, showcasing the brand, and the brand being your organization is super important. And especially just because it fires you up again, because you can meet like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
People mm-hmm. donate to organizations they're like-minded with. They like associating with people who are like-minded. You don't associate with people who are your mortal enemy. You don't like search people out. Like, I disagree with this person on everything in the world. I'm going to hang out with him and have a couple beers. Like, nobody does that. So you want to feel associated with your tribe and, like you said, or your group. And that group mentality is going to help you raise a boatload of money because you feel a bond. And then this person does an event, or this person does something you like and you share and you endorse and you embrace and you donate and you really feel a part of something bigger than yourselves, which is that transformational giving, right? Mm-hmm. You realize that it's not just a check you're writing, or it's not just a credit card you're giving. You're giving part of it to a community that's solving massive issues or massive woes in your community. And there's other people who are doing it too. Like, you don't want to just be the lone wolf out there. I mean, unless you're a lone wolf, but majority of people are not. And I think it's really important to create an environment by which you are proud to share that your story mission as a volunteer or a donor.
It's funny you mentioned the traveling with the t-shirt. I just got back from Egypt. Had a chance to go out. My neighbor out here in Bahrain was getting married in Alexandria. So I went out with them and had a great time with them for a few days. And I swung by Cairo on the way home. I wanted to see the pyramids and the Nile and all that stuff, of course. And I have a picture with my buddy's shirt. Cody Bobet runs Gaborim Studios with Cliff Graham. Amazing duo. They're putting on Marvel quality, Game of Thrones quality movies about Old Testament characters trying to rebuild the fortitude in Christian men. And I'm wearing the Gaborim shirt as I'm standing next to the pyramids. And he's like, can I please use this for my stuff? I want to share. Yes. And I was like, of course, man. I mean, why not? But he was pretty excited about it. And I was, you know, more than happy to share that photo. And he'll be part of that journey.
Love it.
You talk about donors and building that relationship. What is the best way you found to communicate with donors?
Face-to-face. No, bar none, the best way of all. Because mostly if you are in fundraising, you're personable, you're a storyteller, you're nice, you smile, you can read people. And I think reading people is a lot easier when you do it face-to-face. You can tell whether somebody's upset. You can tell whether somebody is not enjoying their conversation. You can easily see that they're just like sitting on their phone and they're not paying attention to you. So you can create a conversation that is, you know, for them. If you can't do it face-to-face, over the phone is secondary, because you can tell most of the time with people's dramatic flair in the inflection in their voice, whether they're really sort of interested in what you're saying or how you're doing. And again, we've got these wonderful supercomputers in our pockets and we use them least for what they were built for purposely, which is calling people on the phone. And I think the least engaging is, I mean, for most people, there's a generation of folks who just text message or just do Messenger. I understand that. But when you're talking with donors and you're talking with engaging donors and trying to get to know them as people, face-to-face or over the phone is absolutely critical. And again, we've got these things like Zoom now where we can record conversations, or we can have conversations where I can see your face and I can see whether you are interested or disinterested in a topic of conversation. This wonderful tool, using technology to your advantage. But if you don't have that, if you can't resonate with somebody, mm-hmm. And you can't see their reaction, a lot of things can get misinterpreted. And I think that through text message or email or just constant social media stuff, we can get lost in our messaging because people can interpret it 1,000 different ways. That's not what I meant, or that's not what I said, or my joke didn't mean like that. You can see how many people right now in the media who say something get blown up out of context, and then it becomes a huge deal. Well, if you're having a face-to-face conversation, you can immediately cut to the chase. It's like, hey, I didn't understand what you just said there. And you can clarify, or you mm-hmm. can, you know, sort of go down a different path. I think you miss that in email only, or you can miss that in social media only things. And again, we know this, that people's lives on social media are not as glamorous as they put it out to be. Your organization is not as awesome in real life as it is on social media. And I think people like the idea of authenticity, and they like the idea of being honest and real players in the field. And to be fair, a lot of fundraisers don't understand that it's not about you, but it's really about you. And if you are not a personable human being, if you're not outgoing, whatever, it's okay. But forcing yourself into situations where you can read people and really and connect with them face to face is so unbelievably critical to building those deep relationships that you can't get from just digital alone.
What's the best advice you can give someone when they're faced with a no?
My best advice is it's okay. It might just be a no now. If you're to the point where you are making large asks, let's just say we'll take this in two routes, because I think there's a small ask no and a large ask no, right? Let's just start with the large and then we'll work our way back down, because I think a lot of people who are just getting started are not going to make $10,000 asks out of the gate. And that's okay. If somebody says no to a $10,000 ask, there's a couple of reasons. One, it's a no right now. I don't have the cash on me, right? Which is fine. Pledge it out. We can come up with solutions. If it's a no, I don't know why you would ask me that question. I'm offended by your, you know, nobody's doing that. You're never put into, I've never been punched in the face for asking for money. So let's just, like, nobody's ever like going around, I hope somebody asked for money today. Whoa-pow. Well, pow and the kisser. Like, nobody's doing that. So if you get faced with a no with a $10,000 ask, let's example, the only thing that happened there is A, they weren't vetted correctly. They don't have it on hand, or they don't feel that they have the ability financially, which is fine. We can figure out other ways. And if the other one is, we went in too early for an ask and we read the tea leaves wrong, and that's okay too. You can always bounce back from that. So if somebody says, no, I'm not interested at all in giving your organization money, that's okay. It's okay. It's okay to have the word no. If you have kids like me, I have three kids. That's all I hear is the word no. I'm desensitized to it by a shot. Every day I just wake up and I go, all right, well, how many no's am I going to get today? So it's fine. And then ask them, like, what other organizations are you interested in? Like, try to align them and try to understand where they're coming from that gift. You probably didn't just vet them enough to say that they are really interested in your organization. If it's a no now, if it's a no right now, or no, not right now, when's a good time, or when is a better time to make an ask? That's your rebuttal out of the gate, because they've already indicated to you that they're probably interested in. And like, you don't want to get into hardcore sales and closing pieces here, but you want to go, well, when's a better time? Is there a better time that you would feel good about giving to our organization at this level? Engage them immediately in conversation. Don't walk away and just go, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't mean to offend you. Because you didn't offend them. They're just telling you right now they're not ready to make a gift. And if it's just a no, I just don't feel like I can do that much. That's a lot of money. Your rebuttal is immediately, well, what's a more comfortable number for you? You clearly love our organization. We want to make you love us even more. We want to give you the option to show us financial, like show us through money, like how much you love us. Is there a more comfortable number for you? Maybe like five. Okay, you just got $5,000. It's great. That's good for you. So I think people get in this trap of like when people say no, it's an immediate rejection, and they, you just stop talking about donations. You stop talking about making asks. And there are simple ways that, you know, sort of the sales, old school sales techniques of just sort of getting them down the path of what they're more comfortable with, or is there a better time? And money is usually the option, or usually the issue why people say no. Usually. It's less about you than it is money. And so giving them a way to navigate this, because you're an organization, you're flexible, they're going to give you cash. It's fine. From the low-level gifts, expect no's. And if you're coming out cold and you're getting sponsorships, or you're making low-level asks for $100, $250, something like that, expect a lot of no's. And any yeses, you're like, okay, now we're happening. Now we're good. So, but provide them a reason to give and an explainer on what your low-level asks are going to be. Because they might not know that your low $100 gift will make this massive five times impact. Mm-hmm. They might not know that. So going back to our earlier conversation of knowing your numbers, is know your numbers at levels that you're going to be asking people for. So does your $100 that you're asking for provide an hour worth of programming for helping kids with disabilities? Say that. This is what it's going to do. It's going to give a child an hour of therapy, physical therapy that's going to help them develop more effectively early, right? Part of our early intervention program, it's $100. So your gift of $100 is going to provide a family who can't afford this type of therapy the ability to have their kid or their child in a better place at the end of the day. Now I, as a donor, can relate a little bit more to where my money's going rather than just, can you give us $100, please? Nobody. No, I don't want to give you $100. So give them a reason to do that. So at a high level, if you make an ask and you get a no, it's either for monetary reasons, they can't afford it right now, and then you just make a follow-up to, well, when's a better time? Or that's a lot of money. Well, is there a more comfortable number than you for you? Or I just have no idea why you just asked me for money. I'm offended by that. But they're not going to say that. But I don't know. I don't. That doesn't make any sense. That's on you for not building a relationship well enough, or reading the tea leaves to say they were ready to be asked in the first place. Or you didn't, you know, so you sort of missed a step there. And that's okay too. You just come back. You're like, well, I apologize. That's not a big deal. I'd love to have coffee with you to give you an update on what this campaign is doing or what our organization are. So you're fine in that realm. And expect on the low end a lot of no's, but be prepared to justify that number that you're asking by getting real specific on the amount of impact that gift you're going to ask for is going to make.
Yeah, I worked with Feed It Forward OKC, And one of their things was, I don't remember the numbers for this ask, but they're like, your $20 feeds 100 people. It was straightforward, to the point. They know exactly what their money was going to impact for. So as a donor, you have the security of knowing that you're making an impact.
Right.
And then they follow that up with videos of days that they're feeding or they're preparing food. And they say, hey, we're getting ready to head out of this. Thank you so much for your donations. This is what we're doing with them today, and this is what we're feeding.
You did that. You did this.
On the backside of it, you know, you have that little area of uncomfortableness for the organization. You said, hey, we had food out here today. We fed this many people. But then here comes the uncomfortable part. You show the line of people that didn't get fed today.
Yeah.
And I think that's hard early for organizations to say, you know, we're doing good stuff and we want to highlight what we're doing. But I think if you don't highlight the need you still have for more money and more donations, it's hard for people to want to say yes to that further gift. Right. Or they think your organization is doing fine, so why would they need your money? But to show this, say, hey, it's great, it's amazing, here's where your money was, we impacted this many people, but my heart is breaking, my heart is hurting, because we still have so many more people that are in need of food today. They're going away hungry, they're going to go to sleep hungry, and we didn't help them today. We really need your continued support. Hey, with your donation of $25 a month, we'll give you this free t-shirt, and you can be part of our vision and our mission.
Right.
Moving forward.
I think that's a really great way of sort of explaining it. Now, you want to be very careful. You don't want to get into inspiration porn, you know, where you are abusing those that you're serving for the purposes of fundraising. You want to give the reality, but not make it so offensive in the like, oh, look at this poor crippled child kind of thing. Again, my buddy Scott Burlingame, who's the executive director of an organization called Independence Inc. up in Minot, North Dakota. He's just a great human being, probably one of the smarter individuals when it comes to like sort of board and process development. He's just brilliant. But he does this talk on inspiration porn. Just future guest reference for you, my friend, because he might be phenomenal as a thing. But he says there's an appropriate level of explanation of what you do and who you serve and how this affects it. And then there is the, oh, look, we're just going to drag out our token, you know, whatever individual and just showcase them just to kind of give the allure of money. And I think nonprofits need to balance that very well, where you just said specifically, like, listen, here's what your money did. The reality is this, we need more to do more. And, with no money, no mission. That's just a really kind of easy concept that I think a lot of donors can get to understand, is that if you don't raise enough money, we can't do the things that we need to do. And your money did this, and just imagine what we can do with more. And that's a really good tag, you know, to sort of scope out new donors as well. You know, we've raised enough. And I think when people get successful, or individual organizations get successful, they get into this trap where, like, well, how do we convey that we need more money since we've raised X amount of dollars? Well, there's always more need. You're never going to get rid of global hunger. You're never going to get rid of all these major issues unless we provide people an avenue to financially support it. And we've done this well. And our big, hairy, audacious goal is this, and help us get there. Like, that kind of becomes the storyline that you sort of nailed perfectly.
Beyond donations, and I know you're a big fundraising guy, have you seen where the use of partnerships is more valuable than monetary donations?
Yes, especially in your board of directors. I think a lot of people who deal with boards are constantly in battle with their responsibility. Do they have a fiduciary responsibility to your organization? Yes. Are they the sole reason and ability to fundraise? I don't know about that. But do they have an obligation to kick down some doors for you? Yes. And I think when people are faced with time, talent, or treasure, when they are being asked to participate with an organization, sometimes we don't know what that talent could be. That talent could be building and bridging relationships and opening doors to other folks who have the capacity to give. And I think that is exponentially more important nowadays, because of so many nonprofits out there that you're competing, you're just quote unquote competing with donor dollars. And I think it becomes very critical for organizations to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to build and bridge relationships and partnerships with people who could eventually become your fiscal sponsors or your fiscal supporters at the end of the day. For example, if your board member says, I don't know anybody. I don't know. I don't even know why I'm on this board. I don't know one person. I go home every day and I close the garage door behind me and I watch TV and I have no social relationships whatsoever. First of all, it's untrue and you're just trying to get an excuse. So I don't know who to ask. I don't know any powerful people. Well, who's your insurance agent? Who'd you buy your house from? Who'd you buy your car from? Who do you buy your groceries at? Where do you go? And like all the people that you write checks to, you have relationships with. So can you make an introduction to me for a business? Or can you make an introduction for our organization at this business perhaps? Because that door unlocking from some third party will have a much more powerful effect with your organization that you could say, well, we didn't get $1 million gift, but we got $1 million in value from partnering with this organization that helped us get our mission down the road. So I think if you can't give treasure, give the talent of opening doors or the time spent building and bridging relationships with other potential partners in the community. Because I think like in North Dakota, we've got 5,100 nonprofits. We don't have 1 million people that live in this state. We've got 5,100 nonprofits. That's a lot of nonprofits. So we're all vying for the same like top 25 donors. Where are the next 150 top donors coming from? If you don't know, let's go find them and explore through relationships and through partnerships, because that's really the key to long-term growth, is figuring out who the next generation of givers is going to be. And that can only be done through some door opening, like you said, through partnerships.
I had the opportunity to read your book, Fundraise Awesomer. I downloaded it on Kindle and I read through it. And you mentioned something in there that as a fundraiser, I haven't really thought about. And this is end of life or estate giving. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that concept?
So your estate gifts are the ultimate goal of a lot of relationship building that you make, right? It's your longest play. And really where I think a lot of organizations are short-sighted is they haven't thought about, you don't need to build a plan. You don't need a planned giving officer. You don't need these end of life, like you don't need that. But what you need to do is start thinking about who in your social circles at your organization have the capacity of giving you a portion of their will when they pass away. Because we're all going to die. News alert, we're all going to die. And you can't take anything with you. So I don't know if you knew this, but unless Elon Musk figures out a way to download your brain and soul into a cyborg, we're all going to go. So the amount of money that people have collected over the years is going to get passed down to their kids and their grandkids, et cetera. Talking about your middle-aged and your older donors about a portion of their proceeds when they pass away going to your charity or your organization is a really interesting play for the long term, because they become, you know, they love you so much and they have watched your journey as an organization for so many years that they want to give a portion of what they have accumulated over their lifetime to benefit the other long-term play of your organization as well. I think it's absolutely critical to have these conversations and talk about terrifying. When you think about the idea of having a conversation about death with your donors, I can imagine that probably puts shivers down your spine. And it's okay to feel really uncomfortable about this, because we don't talk about it. We, especially from the Midwest, and you know this as well as I do from your time spent in our neck of the woods, my friend, is that we don't talk about our feelings a lot. We kind of just jam them down, and it'll be outburst one day when a pet dies. We're like, oh, everything is terrible, but we just hold it in. So we don't like talking about these things. We don't like being uncomfortable in conversation, but really talking about how their lasting impact can be really beneficial, I think, is a delightful topic to talk about when you have these relationships that are invaluable to you, right? So a long-term donor, somebody who's given to you for 10 plus years, somebody who has consistently given to you every, maybe twice, three times a year, somebody who is ideally 75 years old, a elderly woman who has no husband or no kids. Like if you can find that, go find that one. Or an eligible, there's a bachelor up here in Lakes Country who appreciate this one, Trev. He passed away and he had no brothers, no sisters, no wife. Swinging bachelor, owned a ton of property. And when they, the only thing that his friends knew that he really liked cars. He had like 187 cars, classic cars that he collected over a lifetime, stored in storage sheds throughout his property of like his 30 acres of property or whatever it was. And they auctioned him off for charity. Like his estate, I don't know what they raised, but these cars were going for $50,000, $100,000. He had nowhere to give it. And so are you asking the right questions to your older donors about what their intent are or what they're giving their wills and their trusts and their bequests? Like where are those going in casual conversation about life? And the only way you have that conversation is to build relationships well enough that you feel comfortable having a conversation about, hey, when you're dead, where is this going? And you have a softer approach to this, by the way. But when you're gone, where do you see your legacy? Where do you see your massive impact? Now, that's a great long play. If you have somebody who's already dedicated their specific income or a specific percentage of their donor dollars to you, there's a real good chance they can help you now and later. So your conversation then switches over to, would it be really interesting to maybe take a part of that legacy gift and use it now so you can see what your true and wonderful intentions are now? Like, wouldn't it be great to take a portion of what you've already allocated to us and maybe use it now so that you can see your generosity in action? That's an interesting conversation to have if you know your donor base well enough that you know that somebody has a planned gift for you. And building an ask plan around somebody that's already dedicated to your organization could be a very interesting and very fun conversation that these individuals who really love your organization could use it now and then later for the rest. Something to consider.
It's a heck of a concept, and it's not something that I had really thought about. And if I haven't thought about it, I just imagine there's a bunch of people that haven't thought about it for the end of life giving. That's a more established nonprofit's ask.
Yes.
Let's get down to the startup, kind of where this target audience is. And let's talk about fundraiser events that are really fun to put on. What's the funnest fundraiser that you enjoy?
So I'll give you a most recent example as of 2 days ago. So there is a group here in North Dakota that helps individuals with developmental disabilities and a delay. And they did an adult prom. So they had their friends, their families, their sponsors, their organizations dressed to the nines in whatever decade they wanted to experience prom. And invited them out for a dance through the decades sort of fundraiser. They had a spiked punch. They had the greeters at the door that were taking their name tags was a nun and a gym teacher dressed in the 80s. There was a janitor. I was dressed up as a nerdy principal as the MC.
So your regular garb then?
Oh yeah, it was pretty much just went to the closet. We just put something on, put some tape on the glasses. It was easy. It was an easy costume here. But what they did was they nominated a prom court, and they had the prom court raise money for the organization in addition to the fundraiser that was going on for the tickets and the price of the dance, right? And they raised money, and then the prom king and queen were crowned from the highest donor or the highest fundraiser from that group. So you get this group of individuals who don't know each other, who are in the community leaders, raising money on behalf of an organization to become crowned prom king and queen. You want to talk about an event that's outside of the box. That's it. And it was brilliant. Now, Did it have 10,000 people show up to it? No, and it doesn't matter, because what you just did was took a leap of faith doing something radically different to get people talking about it the very next day. To have thoughtfulness about how you have a punch. That, and you remember, high school, oh, there's the punch, and then somebody inevitably is going to spike it with booze. So they just went ahead and made the booze spike punch as your specialty drink. That's a great idea. Or, you know, you have these photo ops and photo booths where you did the terrible prom pictures where you're just like awkward. Like, that's brilliant. And it captures the imagination of people who don't necessarily think about an organization who has the serious job of raising money and advocating for people with disabilities to do something so fun, and realizing that individuals with disabilities are the same as everybody else. They have the same desires to go to prom. They have the same desires to be to dance crazily on the dance floor. And you have this wonderful mix of able-bodied individuals and those with disabilities and in wheelchairs dancing on the same dance floor. And it was the most beautiful thing in the entire world. And that, my friend, will turn into this 300-person event next year, raise a boatload of cash because you thought outside the box and did something different. And I think that's the key to having a good event, is not doing what everybody else is doing and coming up with a theme. And I'm obsessed with the idea of events because it's what I cut my teeth on, and it's what I specifically think is the most beneficial thing to do if you want to talk to the most amount of people and make the most amount of impact. So yes, be fun, do events. And here's the thing, you cannot cheap out on two things. These are the two things you cannot cheap out on events. If you're starting an event and you listen to this podcast, you're an hour in and you get to this point, you're like, oh, finally, somebody's talking to me about events. Well, let's talk about this. The two things, sound and the length of your program. Those are the two things you need to worry about more than anything else. If you don't spend money on good quality sound and you want to talk about your mission and why it's important for everybody to be there, nobody can hear you if you have crappy sound. So you need to invest in that. The second is, everybody remembers the program that went on for too long. Nobody remembers how terrible of a, if the program is short, nobody's going to berate you for that. They will get bored if your program is not long, is too long, and it gets droned on and you're doing the thanks forever and then you're getting off topic, or you get a speaker who may not be scripted. Like, well, I wrote something down here, guys, but let me just tell you a quick story. No, stick to the script. So script out your program and make it short and sweet, and then pay for great quality sound. Visuals can be forgiven. Audio cannot. Yeah.
Sounds like we really hit on a nerve there.
Yeah, there's a nerve of mine.
Yeah.
My wife doesn't go to special events with me anymore because I just sit in the back. If I haven't been involved with it, I just sit in the back like, I wouldn't do that. Nope, I wouldn't do that. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, I would improve this. Like, she's like, would you just enjoy it for the sake of enjoying it? I can't.
No, they've ruined it for me, and I cannot come back.
I know too much.
So you are the dedicated fundraiser of your organization. How do you structure your week in order for you to stay sane throughout the week?
Boy, if there was only a book written for the sole purpose, my friend, if there was only a book. So I've broken it down into five days. And I don't use 7 days because, dang it, you work too hard. You need a weekend to relax and recharge, okay? But the idea is, if you don't know where to start and you have no idea how to orchestrate your day in order to move the needle forward, break it down into five small, tangible goals for the week. And do it in 20 minutes or 40 minutes or how much time you have. And you spend every day doing one thing to move the needle forward, okay? And I've broken it down like this, where it's Mondays are for planning, Tuesdays are for doing, Wednesdays are for documenting, Thursdays are for celebrating, and Fridays are for appreciating. And if you just do those five things every day, every week, you are going to be a more effective fundraiser down the line. And the idea of planning is you have to just wait for all hell to break loose, because you know it is, right? So what are the priorities you need to make sure you get done in the week? Spend a little time on Monday making sure you carve out enough time to do those things. doing is really important, because you can talk about all these things. You can talk about like, how, you know, I'd really like to do this, or I'd really like to plan all these things. If you're not out of the office making asks or doing something to move the needle forward, you need to spend some time out of the office, away from your computer. I mean, listen to this while you're driving and commuting, and then listen to this podcast on repeat in your spare time. But get out of the office. Do something outside of your computer. Nobody's ever raised $1 billion sitting from behind their computers doing this. Nobody. So get out of the office. And then after you've had these awesome meetings, make sure you document all of the cool things you learned about your donors. You know, the how many kids they have, grandkids, where they like to travel, their favorite color, favorite car, whatever the thing you learn about them that's not the size of their wallet, document that. And I don't care if it's in a system, on a notebook, or a cocktail napkin. Get it down out of your brain and onto paper. Third thing is, we are terrible about celebrating. And if you forget why you do this job and you don't celebrate your wins, you're going to get burned out real quickly. So spend some time every week celebrating what you do as an organization or what you did personally to move the needle forward, and end your week writing thank you notes. Travis, you do a wonderful job of hammering this home on your posts and in your podcasts, but hammer home the idea of handwritten thank you notes. If you do nothing else from a listening to my advice of 15 years as a fundraiser and as an author and a speaker and as somebody who does this for a living, spend time every week writing thank you notes. If you write 5 handwritten thank you notes a week, there are 52 weeks in the year. That means you have 260 handwritten thank you notes out into the world every single year. If you have 2 people in your office, that's over 500 thank you notes, handwritten, from just celebrating somebody's win or appreciating them for their leadership or appreciating them for not even being a part of your organization, just appreciating them for being a good human being. You become known as the organization or the person that becomes full of gratitude first. And if you can lead and end with gratitude, you are great. And then by the time you're planning your work week on Monday, and you're trying to plan your meetings, and you send a telephone message or you send a Facebook message to somebody you're trying to have a meeting with, the last thing you remember is that nice little thank you note or the thank you phone call that you made. And they know that you care about them on a level that's not just monetary. And that's really critical to your thing. So, you know, planning, doing, documenting, celebrating, and appreciating. If you do those 5 things, you will move the needle forward as somebody who is just an accidental fundraiser or somebody who doesn't know where to start.
Tell me about the absolute disaster of a fundraiser that you've done. The one that you set up, you did all the work, all the planning, and man, it just didn't go how you planned it.
The one fundraising appeal that was a disaster was an end of year appeal I did years ago where I sent it out too late. And so this is critical. Now we're talking about the end of the year. We're coming up to end of calendar, Thanksgiving and Christmas. There's a time where if you don't get your appeals out on time, if you're not scheduling out and planning those things, where the appeal for the giving day got into people's homes the day after the event was over. And you think like, let's just, how many things have to go wrong for you to have nothing go out for a fundraiser? And then the day after your fundraising event, they get the invitations. You want to talk about a disaster of epic proportions. It's that. My classic fundraising ask story is I took the leap of faith by flying across the country to go meet with a potential major donor that we had everything sort of mapped out. Now, we were doing a pre-capital campaign, and we were visiting with all of our donors who had really high capacity. A gentleman popped up on our radar who had been giving to us for years, and so that's a really good indication that he really likes our organization. But one of our board members at the time had somebody else do a gift analysis on what the potential for this person was and how much he had in potential. He said, Pat, I think this person is ripe. We think we can get 6 figures out of him. In fact, ask for $250,000 and we'll get a lot of money. So I flew out to California on a whim. The idea that this person was, had the capacity to give 6 figures plus. And I sit down in his house. And it's a very modest house, which is a lot of, you know, secret millionaires don't live extravagantly, right? They live as paupers, and they probably sleep on sacks of money. And this gentleman comes to the door, and it is a not pretty home. And he sits me up. He's the nicest human being possible. Given to us for years. And I make my pitch, and I said, hey, I'd love to ask you for lots of money in the six-figure range. And he laughed at me. And I thought he was laughing because he's like, oh, about time somebody figured out I had all this money. And he laughed. He said, Pat, you got me mixed up with somebody else. I don't know where you came up with that number. But that is, I do not have $250,000. But I'll give you a check for $2,000, which paid for my flight, my car rental, my hotel fee. And clearly he knew that I needed to pay for a drink at a bar after that ask. And that's probably what we got. And it was one of those things where you need to, you know, take a leap of faith. Yes, you're going to have some errors. Make asks. You know, you're not going to get your 100% wins. Take risks when you have conversations. Take a leap of faith, but know that you might get something wrong every once in a while, and it's not all roses or whatever. Now, I take that from a positive entity where I got to actually meet the person who'd been a donor for a long period of time, and he hadn't had anybody from our organization come and visit him for 20 years. I take pride in the fact that I know that that person continuously donates every single year going forward. And he's probably going to leave us in their will. There's going to be a lot of money down the road. What we did make the mistake of that the actual person who had all the money was his brother who lived down the road, and it wasn't him. Same last name, just not the right person. So.
Did you salvage it? Did you go see the brother on the same trip, or did you find that out?
No, later? I did. We didn't find out that he had a brother. His brother was there for a while. However, I did salvage the trip. There was another donor who was related to our founding namesake of our organization, and I'd set up a meeting with them and got them on for a real major gift afterwards. So we salvaged the trip, but that one, I mean, I still remember the smell of the house, the smirk on his face. The utter gut-wrenching feeling of him saying, oh, you got the wrong guy. He was so nice about it. And that's the point of this is, it's like people are not going to be offended if you ask for too much. They're not. As much as that was gut-wrenching to me, and as much as it was just an abject failure of us connecting the dots from money available to money executing, and I still think I'm a pretty good asker when it comes to fundraising, it's not always a failure. And I think if you can take lessons and live in this glass half full kind of world, especially because you have to in this fundraising neck of the woods, to know that your, you know, $200,000 ask is not going to garner more than 1% of that. To know that you've done your due diligence as an organization, you've spread the message, you've built a relationship a little further, you take your lumps and you learn from it. I think that's really a lesson that you need out of the gate. So not too bad.
I love it how you went out and you made this ask, and it kind of blew up in your face, and you still kept on the path. You still kept doing what you were doing. You recovered, and you went to see another donor and got the big ask and got a little bit of reward out of it.
Well, once you get rejected from a $250,000 gift and you just get no, really, it's a lot easier. I think the hardest thing is having that come out of your mouth. Right. The hardest thing to ask for is a large gift, because nobody does this on a regular basis. Right. And I've probably asked for a specific amount of money, maybe a dozen times in my career. Usually it's a, would you consider a gift of some of this range? Right. You're not making a specific ask. But yeah, that's a tough one to spit out. And once you do it, you're like, oh, it's not a big deal. We're all human. We're all fine. It's fine.
I think so many people get wrapped up on taking it personal when they make the ask, and they get to know they take it on themselves. And it's not about you. This podcast isn't about me. It's not about Pat. No. It's about the organization and the mission that we're trying to move forward, because we care so much about it.
Yeah.
And if you've taken the time to build a relationship with the donor, you know that they care so much about it as well. So
they also know that you're a fundraiser. So this is the other thing that drives me nuts, is that when people say, well, what if they say no? Well, they might say no, but they also know that you're coming to ask for money, right? You don't invite a development director or an executive director to a lunch or a coffee and not expect them to ask you for money. So like, you might not want to ask them for money. You might want to build a relationship. But if you make an ask, they're not, people aren't dumb. They know, what? You're a fundraiser and you ask me for money? I didn't think that this was going to be a conversation we had today. Of course you do. You said yes to the meeting. You know exactly who's coming to your meeting. You know exactly who you said yes to. You've already won the battle as a fundraiser. Now it's just a matter of sort of aligning them correctly with the amount of money they're comfortable with at an organization they already believe in because they said yes to the meeting. So know that right away. I mean, you're going to be fine. You know, get over the nervousness and make an ask and align them correctly and have them comfortable with whatever they're going to give you. And poof, you're a successful fundraiser.
It's just so easy when you say it that way, right?
I know. Poof. You know, poof. And it is, and I think I get told that a lot. So you're not alone in this where like, Pat, you make it seem so easy because it is. You're just storytelling and relationship building and providing your potential donors or your potential supporters a financial avenue on how they can convey how much they appreciate what you're doing in the community. That's it. That's fundraising in a nutshell. That's it. You're telling stories, you're building relationships, and you're providing donors with a path to financially feel good about what they're going about to do. That's it. Anybody who's telling you differently is telling you wrong, frankly, because it's not, you're not doing something weird or outside of the box. They know you're a fundraiser. They want to help. They clearly have love for your organization, and you're just trying to clarify what makes them feel great at the end of the day. And that's that transformative gift. That's less transactional than it is transformative. That's the fullest expression of joy and love that you're going to give to an organization is I'm going to give my hard-earned cash, time, or my network to you because I believe in what you're doing. And the only way they get to the point of them believing what you're doing is if you build wonderful, delightful, enthusiastic, and loving relationships. And yeah, I said loving relationships, not foo-foo anymore. I mean, I think we can talk about that in terms of like they love your organization and they ask you, how can I help? And you have a litany of things ready for them because you've done your due diligence, you've done your homework, you know your numbers, you feel comfortable in your role. If you don't, you know that you can go get the answer anyway. And at the end of the day, we've got a number of ways that you can help. This, and this. What do you think about helping us in this manner? Or how can you, or what's going to make you feel great about helping us today? That's it. Fundraiser. Now you're a fundraiser.
That answer of how can I help? That's an answer you need to have on tap. You need to have determined and designed.
Yes.
Talk to a few people and I've asked them, how can we help? And they're like, well, we don't really need any help. I was like, really? You don't need people with time. You don't need people with money. You don't need people with relationships. You don't need people's skills, talents, ability, or connections. They're like, oh yeah, well, we kind of need those things. I'm like, of course you do. But to say that you don't have any asks is wrong.
I know.
You have that conversation. They want to help you. And I want to help you, Patrick. I want to know what me and my team can do to help you on your vision, on your quest, on your next venture.
I've been really thinking hard about how I can make maximum impact to as many people as possible. And I'm only one human being. I understand that. And so I'm really sort of bridging to this online space where I can get experts from across the field, including yourself, by the way. We have to talk offline about this because I think it's going to happen. And I built Do Good University. And it's an online platform where we're going to have experts talking about 101 basic fundraising principles. This is not a place for the 30-year university system veteran who knows all and is all powerful, whatever. This is for the accidental fundraiser. This is for the person who just needs to get their feet wet or they just need to understand basic concepts, whether it's appeal writing, special event checklists, end of year planning sheets, board onboarding or recruitment, anything in between, sort of social media marketing. What does it mean to do a post? All the 101 classes we're going to host at Do Good University, Do Good YOU University. And we're gonna launch this sort of the signature course is based on my book Fundraise Awesomer. It's gonna give you sort of a step by step mastermind group accountability partners with this sort of intense questioning and accountability group to make sure that you have everything you need to do and everything you need to be a successful fundraiser. So that's our signature course. And then we're going to have a whole host of courses that start October 1st that you can take a la carte, and they take 3 or 4 hours a piece. And it's a ton of content, and it's video trainings and ebooks and guest expert trainings. And then you get to be in this little small private group on private Facebook groups to answer all your questions as well. So I'm really, really excited about this. It's kind of where the new frontier is, to kind of reach as many people as possible and do the maximum amount of good. And so that's really, I'm excited. And then if you want to fundraise awesomer, feel free to go on Amazon and pick up your book, your copy of Fundraise Awesomer. And I appreciate you reading it. I really appreciate you getting it. And it's really a fun and simple way to understand how to get out of your own way and carve out some time to do fundraising. And I was really purposeful in how to approach it from a fun, this is not at all scary, sort of way. And I really appreciate you, purchasing it and reading it and being awesome. So
I try to do what I can. Let the people know how they can get a hold of you. What social media, email, phone number, whatever you want to share.
Sure. You can visit me at dogoodbetterconsulting.com. You can email me at patrick@dogoodbetterconsulting.com. You can find me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn at Fundraising Dad. Or you can find me on Facebook, either Do Good Better Consulting or Do Good University. Or you can, hop on Facebook and just message me or give me a buzz through our website, and we'll help out. And again, I've never said no to a meeting. I've never said no to a coffee meeting. I don't charge for any of these inquiries. Hey, I got a quick question. Good, I got a quick answer. Here you go. I find value in giving people as much value as possible. Join our Do-Gooders Network. We're on Facebook, in a little closed group of sort of masterminding crew as well. And any way I can help you guys, let me know. And of course, I'm excited for you because you're doing the Lord's work here, giving the podcast and another bunch of voices talking about how nonprofits can thrive at the basic level, my friend. I mean, you've got the niche here, and I'm ecstatic to be a part of it. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you again, Patrick. Love to have you on the show again. So much, just more than an hour of just nonstop content, nonstop value of how you can impact, how you can change your future, how to actually get money in the bank so you can do the good you planned on doing, and all the sorts of ways to make that happen. Thanks so much, Patrick. Glad to have you on the show. Can't wait for the next one.
Love it.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.